Hello and welcome back to Cover to Cover, where today we're talking about a quite remarkable old English poem called The Wanderer. Now, I first came upon this poem when I was studying English literature at university in New Zealand. I was not exactly ordered, but certainly strongly encouraged by my teachers to take a paper on medieval English. They gave me to understand that of the numerous holes in my literary culture, so to speak, this one was particularly glaring and needed fixing. And of course, how could anybody turn down the opportunity to study Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? But in fact, when we did this paper on Old English and Medieval English, the work that made the biggest impression on me was a poem written more than 1,200 years ago, probably around the year 900, called The Wanderer. Now, of course, since the poem was written something like 150 years before the Norman invasion of England and the subsequent transformation of the English language, it was written in Old English. And so, like most native speakers of English, I am unable to read it in its original form. Luckily for me, at the time we were studying that poem, a young English academic called Michael Alexander, who went on to become a professor at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, had just updated his very slim Penguin volume called The Earliest English Poems. And I have to this day my copy of that book. Indeed, I have two copies. I was hugely impressed with the way that Alexander transposed the ethos and the language of these old poems into modern English. Now, as far as The Wanderer is concerned, there are, of course, other translations of the poem available, but I have always remained faithful to Michael Alexander's version that I discovered as an undergraduate. The poem is about a man forced into exile, forced to wander because his lord has died or been killed, and the man, the wanderer, no longer has a clan to which he can attach himself. The poem ends with a Christian-sounding stanza about seeking forgiveness from the Heavenly Father. But as Alexander points out in his introduction to the book, those final lines, which are quite different in style and meter to the rest of the poem, were quite likely added later on, perhaps by the monk who transcribed this poem onto parchment. The tone and feel of the poem are not Christian at all. It begins, "Who liveth alone longeth for mercy." Now, perhaps that word mercy is also an addition by a monk or a substitution by a monk. The whole first stanza and the beginning of the second stanza run like this. "Who liveth alone longeth for mercy, though he must traverse tracts of sea, sick at heart, trouble with oars, ice-cold water, the ways of exile, weird is set fast." Thus spoke a grasshopper, old griefs in his mind, cold slaughters, the deaths of dear kinsmen. Note that initial alliteration with the TR sound. Traverse, tracts of sea, trouble with oars. Alliteration is, of course, used in all sorts of English poems right up to our own time, but it is absolutely fundamental to the rhythms of Anglo-Saxon poetry, which, of course, was oral poetry. In other words, these were poems that were recited aloud. They were declaimed by a poet called a scop in a hall to the sound of a harp. Originally, these poems were not written down. And Alexander suggests that a poem like The Wanderer may well have been written down a century or more after it was first conceived. As I said, perhaps by a monk in a monastery, and perhaps that's why we got those extra lines about heavenly forgiveness. This was oral poetry, and as in other oral poetry traditions, Homer, for example, it employs verbal formulae, a sound structure, to make it easier for the poet, the scop, to hold the whole story of the poem in his mind as he goes along. And while we're on the topic of those first alliterations with traverse and tract and trouble, let me say again that the Anglo-Saxon poet, of course, uses quite different words, because traverse, tract and trouble are all words that came into English through Latin and French, i.e. after the arrival of the Normans in 1066 and the injection of French and Latin into English. In French, traverser is a very common verb meaning to cross, as in j'ai traversé la rue. Another common verb is troubler, as in ce qu'elle a dit m'a troublé. And as I say, both come originally from Latin, and they give us this magnificent alliteration because, quite simply, to traverse tracts of trouble could be a summary of the whole poem. Alexander's translation, to my mind, is inspired. He refers to this man as a grasshopper. In other translations I've seen, he's sometimes called an earth stepper, which is another nice way of expressing it. But he's a wanderer. He's an exile. His fate is to roam sea and land in search of a new lord, because his former lord has died. The first part of the poem consists of his speech, his complaint, if you like. Alone am I driven each day before daybreak to give my cares utterance. None are there now among the living to whom I dare declare me thoroughly, tell my heart's thought. His heart is heavy with sorrow. He has no one to confide in. He is stunned, if you like, by the inexorable power of fate. As he puts it, the ways of weird are set fast. Now, weird is a quintessentially Anglo-Saxon word. It comes from an Anglo-Saxon verb meaning to be. And I've always liked weird in this old sense. It means what is, what happens, the way things happen, and by extension, personal destiny, fate. Weird is set fast, fate is inexorable. Now, of course, the word makes a very famous appearance in Shakespeare's play Macbeth. Everybody knows the witches in Macbeth and the famous lines, for example, double, double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. But what fewer people know is that In fact, in the play Macbeth, Shakespeare never refers to those characters as witches. He refers to them as the Weird Sisters. In other words, those three women are spokeswomen for fate. In modern English, we would say that they channel fate. And like the Wanderer, they have felt the unforgiving force of Weird. As with him, a coldness has entered their bones. They are outcasts. The Wanderer says, "No weary mind may stand against Weird, nor may erect will work new hope." Here the alliteration is obviously with W's, weary, weird, wrecked will work. This man remembers with sorrow the friendship that he used to enjoy with his lord and his kinsmen. He remembers people gathering together joyously in the smoke-filled mead hall. When I say mead hall, I mean the hall where they would drink mead and beer. People clustering there at night after a hard day's work. He remembers the jokes and the teasing, the smoke from the food being cooked. He remembers the horns of beer and mead being passed around, perhaps his lord's voice booming out from the top table, calling perhaps for a singer or a scop to perform. In this harsh period when England was repeatedly invaded by Viking war groups, when indeed 40% of the territory of what we think of as England was occupied by the Vikings, every day of survival, of fellowship in the face of enemies, disease, hunger and death, in the face of Weird, was a day to be celebrated. How comforting it used to be for him to see his lord sitting up there at the big table, providing protection, safety, and good cheer. Now, I mentioned the word kinsmen. Anglo-Saxon society was a collection of close-knit clans or kins, each loyal to its lord. The word kin, spelt C-Y-N-N, and which is also in the word king in English, by the way, is the ancestor of the English word kin, and therefore also of kinsmen or kindred, as in the expression a kindred spirit. And it's also the ancestor of the word kind, not in the sense of being charitable or generous, but in the sense of mankind or humankind. To bring up Shakespeare again, remember how Hamlet, in Act 1, Scene 2 of the play, puns on the words kin and kind in his very first retort to Claudius. Claudius publicly asks how Hamlet is, referring to him as his cousin and his son, and Hamlet murmurs bitterly, "A little more than kin and less than kind." In the harsh, insecure world that the Wanderer inhabits, a man who loses his lord, his gold friend, the man who provides, in other words, food, safety, companionship, the man who loses that person is orphaned. He becomes an outcast. So must I also curb my mind, cut off from country, from kind far distant, by cares overworn, bind it in fetters. This since long ago, the ground's shroud enwrapped my gold friend. Wretched went I thence, winter-wearied, over the waves bound, dreary I sought hall of a gold-giver, where far or near I might find him who in mead hall might take heed of me, furnish comfort to a man friendless, win me with cheer. I think this is another tremendous passage. Shroud is another Old English word, i.e. a word ultimately derived from Norse or German. Our hero is separated from his kinsmen, worn out with care and worry ever since the cold earth wrapped his gold friend in its shroud. He roams about trying to find a new gold giver, someone who can afford him the gold of comfort, the cheer of a new mead hall, somebody who will just take him in. That line rendered by Alexander, him who in mead hall might take heed of me, seems quite inspired to me with its mead heed, mead might, hall heed, as well as having him and me, in a sense, stranded at the two ends of the line, separated by all those intervening words. It's an amazing piece of transposition. The problem for our wanderer is that in a society where a lord had to be responsible for his followers, it was not easy for an older man to gain acceptance in a new kin, a new clan. He knows who makes trial, how harsh and bitter is care for companion to him who hath few friends to shield him. Track ever taketh him, never the taught gold, not earthly glory, but cold heart's cave. He minds him of hall men, of treasure giving, how in his youth his gold friend gave him to feast, fallen all this joy. So track ever taketh him. He's always on the road, on the sea, never secured in comfort. When Alexander writes, never the talked gold, I assume that this is a reference to a type of jewellery called a torque that was worn as a bracelet around the arm or sometimes as a collar around the neck, and which signified high social status. I actually once saw in the British Museum a very famous torque called the Snittisham torque, which dates from about 75 BC. It's made of gold and it weighs about a kilo. This torque tradition carried on for centuries right up to the time when this poem was composed. But this wanderer has no torque, no earthly glory. All he has is the cave of a cold heart. His joy is fallen. There's another extraordinary passage from Alexander's modern English version in which he alliterates F sounds, B sounds, and S sounds. It goes like this: awakeneth after, this friendless man seeth before him fallow waves, sea birds bathing, broading out feathers, snow and hail swirl, hoarfrost falling. Then all the heavier his heart's wounds, sore for his loved lord, sorrow freshens. I love that image of seabirds bathing, broading out feathers, and I have never ever seen the word broad used as a verb in any other context. I take it to mean that the seabirds, who are the creatures that the wanderer sees most often as his boat bobs on the sea, sailing from one place to another. These seabirds are molting feathers, in other words, replacing some of their feathers. But at some gut level, I'm also affected by the fact that broad rhymes with hoard, which is a crucial old English word meaning treasure. And I'm probably also affected by the fact that broad suggests a kind of vast seabird network or fellowship freewheeling over the waves, which to them, of course, are fallow land, if you like, the exact type of brotherhood that the wanderer no longer has access to. Whether wheeling in the sky, calling out to each other, or bobbing on the surface of the ocean, these seabirds are, of course, totally at home in this marine environment, whereas the wanderer is unable to find his clansmen, his brothers. Remembered kinsmen press through his mind. He singeth out gladly, scanneth eagerly. Men from the same hearth, they swim away. Oh, it's a poignant image, those faces glimpsed in memory that swim away. The poem goes on. A wise man may grasp how ghastly it shall be when all this world's wealth standeth waste, even as now in many places over the earth walls stand wind-beaten, hung with hoar frost, ruined habitations. The wine halls crumble, their wielders lie bereft of bliss, the band all fallen proud by the wall. War took off some, carried them on their course hence. One a bird bore over the high sea, one the hoar wolf dealt to death, one his drear-cheeked earl stretched in an earthen trench. So many absolutely splendid images and alliterations, bereft of bliss, for example, and this sorrowing, drear-cheeked earl who is obliged to stretch out one of his followers in an earthen trench, a grave. The word earl is another quintessentially Anglo-Saxon word, and of course, it alliterates with earthen. But the images of waste and destruction pile up, walls beaten down by the winds, hung with hoar frost, wine halls crumbling. There is very little comfort anywhere for this poor wanderer. And in another remarkable tour de force passage, Alexander gives us a series of W sounds and H sounds along with the term hoard sharer. As I mentioned earlier, in Old English, a hoard, spelled H-O-R-D, was a treasure, a valuable stock or store, an accumulation of something preserved for future use. So the poem goes, a man who on these walls wisely looked, who sounded deeply this dark life, would think back to the blood spilled here, weigh it in his wit. His word would be this, where is that horse now? Where are those men? Where is the hoard sharer? Where is the house of the feast? Where is the hall's uproar? The poet then adds an elegiac coda, which Alexander translates using the French word alas, the root of which is the word las, meaning tired or weary, as in, for example, elle se sent lasse, and which you find in the modern English word lassitude, both a physical and a mental or spiritual weariness. Alas, bright cup. Alas, burnished fighter. Alas, proud prince. How that time has passed. Dark under night's helm, as though it had never been. There is no consolation here. The victory of winter, of night, of hail, of the agents of weird is complete. But oh, so brilliantly expressed by poet and translator, a genuine word hoard.